I'm aboard the battleship Pretension. I am Scott Nye.
I am David Bax. Tyler Smith is not here, though you just heard him last week.
Great episode.
I'm sure that was... Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of fun to do. Hopefully he'll be back. We try to do at least once a month while he's in his extended hospital stay. You can, by the way, you can donate to the GoFundMe to help Tyler. It's pinned to the top of the homepage at battleshipretention.com. And also just follow him on Twitter and Facebook. I don't know if he's on Threads yet. I don't know if he's gotten a Blue Sky invite yet. I don't know if he's on... What was the one we were all on that stopped working immediately that I've already forgotten the name of?
Hive,
yeah. I already deleted it. I don't even have it anymore.
Yeah, I should delete that. I certainly do not
use it. I guess I gave up on it.
Oh, dang. Tyler is about a little over $1,000 away from that $100,000 goal. So get donating, folks.
Yeah, yeah. The finish line is in sight.
It is.
So check that out. In the meantime, what I can't, I'm seeing Tyler this, well, by the time you're hearing this, well, I've already seen him, but I'm seeing him this weekend. And one thing I can't wait to talk to him about is Jason Bailey's article for GQ that was just sort of like an editorial slash kind of just like explainer in a way of just like, here's why David Zaslav is so hated right now.
And it was pitched to him from the editor at JQ, like with that was the assignment of like, write a piece on why David Zaslav is the most hated man in Hollywood. He's like, can do.
Yeah. And so he did. And it was, luckily it's been archived and you can still find it like, elsewhere on the internet. Cause it's, as is often the case with Jason, not to like blow smoke up his ass, but like, it's very well written.
Yep.
This just for those who somehow don't know, and it's fine if you don't, you live in the real world, that's fine. Although this is like gotten into the real world, which we'll get to in a second. He wrote this piece, I guess, shortly thereafter. Now we've since learned that David Zaslav's people at Warner Brothers Discovery reached out to GQ with some complaints. They sort of bowdlerized the piece, and Jason asked them to take his byline off it because he didn't stand by their re-edited version. And then they said, we don't run posts without bylines, so we'd have to take it down. And he said, go ahead. And they took it down. And then it came out that Warner Brothers is currently developing a movie based on a GQ article from like 2018. And Will Welch, one of the editors who was in charge of the decision of pulling down Jason Bailey's piece, is a producer on this movie that is being developed at Warner Brothers.
Yeah. Real messy.
And just so, I mean, if the point, to the extent that the point of Jason's original article was David Zaslav is bad at this, he couldn't have like bolstered the argument more than essentially Streisand affecting this thing to the point where like it has, I mean, like GQ is a mainstream publication, but this was still a niche like entertainment piece.
Well, but now, and it's like one of like 50 pieces just like it that have been written over the last couple weeks.
Right. But I guess Warner Brothers through Condé Nast, because GQ is owned by Condé Nast and Condé Nast has some sort of, so like Warner Brothers essentially has some pull over GQ.
Oh, I guess. I get why they were able to take action on this one. I'm just saying that like it, as further evidence that it would have just gotten lost in the shuffle, like all these other pieces are just like little talked about for that day, kind of, but then everyone moves on.
Yeah. But a news publication pulling an article because of a complaint by the article subject, whether it's entertainment or not, that caught the attention of, I think, sort of the journalism sphere at large. And now Washington Post and Politico are covering this, or at least pointing eyes toward it. And it's been a disaster for David Zaslav. Like, I feel like Jason like has achieved more than he ever could have thought he would achieve by writing this. I feel like so many more people are going to be aware of why David Zaslav is so hated than they would have if David Zaslav hadn't had this thing pulled. It's just a rousing success. And
Yeah, it's worth noting that Warner Brothers said their complaints were around factual inaccuracies or that sort of thing. But as Jason pointed out, you can view the two pieces side by side, and the facts of the case aren't changed at all. The only thing that's changed is the degree to which they're described and the language used to ascribe meaning to those actions.
Yeah, they said that, like, GQ didn't reach out to us to confirm these facts. But this wasn't, like, an investigative piece of reportage. Like, this was an editorial, and all of the incidents that Jason refers to in it are already public and documented. He didn't make anything up. All that stuff is already a matter of public record. He just put it all in one place, like I said, as a sort of explainer. This is why he is so hated.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's prime Streisand affecting, and I don't know. I mean, I've heard mixed about whether or not, like, bad press really bothers people at Zaslav's level, because, like, they're still making money kind of thing, but it does seem to really genuinely get under his skin, which is kind of sweet.
Yeah, he wouldn't have, like, reached out like this if it didn't get under his skin, I would imagine. That's speculation, obviously.
Maybe it might be a thing where he just has directed people to reach out about certain types of articles. I don't know, or if it, like, genuinely crossed his desk or not, but at the very least, it also kind of goes hand in hand with some folks pointed out early on in the writer's strike that Warner's put out those signs outside the studio that was, like, warning about excess noise to try to get people to stop honking in favor of the writers. It's just, like, there's real thin skin all over Warner Brothers, and in a town that is all based on perception. It's hard to imagine this not affecting Zaslav's long-term viability at Warner Brothers, but maybe that's wishful thinking.
But I mean, he is clearly very bad at this. Warner Brothers, by the way, is, in all this time, the only place I've passed picketers and honked, because I don't, unlike you, I don't live in the heart of things like you do. I'm not, like, passing Paramount every day on my way to the grocery store or whatever. I have passed Warner Brothers, and I look for those signs. I think they've already taken them down or changed the, LED, right? So I think they've changed the thing, which is too bad. I would have liked to have. So I would have felt even more happy about my honking.
Sure. Also, just to promote Jason a little bit, he also hosts a very good podcast called, I think, A Very Good Year. That's just inviting guests on to talk about their favorite years of cinema, that I listen to fairly regularly. And highly recommend people check that out if you want some more of Jason's whole deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Big Bailey fans here. Not George Bailey, although we're a fan of George Bailey too.
Aren't we all?
Yeah.
What other Baileys are there?
But there's got to be some other ones. Why don't you think of some while I pull up? Because I have an extra ad to read.
I'm excited.
We've got...
what product am I standing behind this week?
This week is comedy sketches interspersed with weekend update style jokes about current events. And with the writer's strike still going on, it's a great way to get your fix of topical comedy. Now, this is aimed at Angelenos, the people who will be in the Los Angeles area over the next couple months. Tickets are $15 at the door and available at the theater's website. The theater is openfist.org, or the theater's website is openfist.org at the Open Fist Theater Company. The show is booked for every Thursday at 8 p.m. through August 17th for the time being. If you show up at these shows, you could help extend their run of weekly topical news-based comedy at this week at the Open Fist Theater Company. They just recently did their 50th show, so they're going strong. Each show features a guest star from film, television, or local theater. Past guests include Jeremy Guskin, Craig Kakowski, and Mike McShane. The show features a rotating group of writers and performers who have studied at the Second City, Improv Olympic, UCB, Groundlings, and elsewhere. A friend of the show, Dave Amiot, has been a contributing writer and will be in the cast on July 13th. That's this week. This is an important part, because integrity is so important to Dave Amiot. He wanted us, David and Tyler and Scott to make sure to mention that this is a paid advertisement. We have not seen the show and cannot vouch for its quality.
But you should definitely go.
But yeah, Dave wanted me to say that, that this is a paid ad and I have not seen the show, but Dave is funny. I'm sure it's funny. Open Fist Theaters in Atwater Village. There's a free parking lot two blocks south of the theater, or there's free street parking. So for tickets, again, go to openfist.org for tickets for this week. And then of course, as usual, I have to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. You know what else I listened to today?
I have no idea.
I decided to jump back into some memories from childhood and listen to Peter and the Wolf. Sergei.
Never listened to them.
Prokofiev. No, Peter and the Wolf, the
opera. Oh, right.
Right. Or the, is that what it is? Cause it's not an opera. Cause it's, there's no singing in it.
Yeah. Kind of a,
it's a symphony based on the story of Peter and the Wolf.
Yeah.
And I listened to it. Sergei Prokofiev. Listened to it today. It took me back to definitely watching in like elementary school Peter and the Wolf, like a cartoon set to the music. Sounded great in my tweakedaudio.com earbuds that are available at a low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Scott, we're back.
Hello.
Let's get into it, shall we? We're halfway through the year, and this is...
Past it at this point.
Yes. Okay. Thanks. This is where we take a break and look back at the half year so far and count down our personal top five, again, of the year so far. This always ends up being an interesting episode in retrospect because, you know, so many of the things that are expected to be contenders for awards or year-end lists or whatever have their releases weighted toward the end of the year that... I always feel like it's a real motley crew, a real ragtag bunch of movies at the halfway point. And it's fairly rare that maybe one movie from my top five of the halfway point ends up on my top 10.
For the year. I think I had three last year. I had at least two. Wow. I can't remember if there was a third.
Yeah, but I I'm going to keep dropping names and bragging. I just got accredited for TIFF. So,
Jason Bailey, watch out. David's going to be there.
Yeah. So who knows? Everything I see at TIFF might blow these movies out of the water, but I do have a kind of, a strange, varied list. And I will also, this is the, listeners get ready to get mad at my OCD, but I'm counting like 2023 native movies. So like movies that played festivals in 2022 and opened theatrically in 2023. I'm not counting. I might call those out at the end as a kind of like honorable mention. And some of those might even be better than what are on my list, but these are movies that are sort of that premiered and released in the first half of 2023. And as a result of that, as often happens with this list, all American movies.
Yeah. I was going to say 4 out of my 5 picks our movies that premiered last year and got released this year.
So this will be a fun, varied list.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you kick things off?
All right, sure.
Your number five.
My number five is Charlotte LeBron's debut film, Falcon Lake. This is based on a graphic novel by Bastien Vivez. It is a coming of age story about a 13-year-old boy who's going on vacation with his mother. They're staying with some friends of the family. Like, it's her mom's like old friend kind of situation. He and her mom's friend's daughter kind of grew up together, but now they're kind of at a point in life where they're at very different ages. So he's 13 and she's 16, which, you know, you can imagine in past years might not be that big difference, but the development years and teen years stake some pretty wide disparities. So he's still kind of in childhood mode and she's very much in her rebellious teenage phase. And there's kind of a weird haunting quality hanging over the film. She's constantly telling these ghost stories that aren't logged anywhere, and which she's either completely making up or which are actually happening to her. And Charlotte LeBron films this in such a way that
it's LeBron, by the way.
Ah, son of a bitch. Thank you, though. Charlotte LeBron films this in such a way that there always is a sense that something supernatural might be happening just around the corner. There's a part where they're out with some older boys and one of them like pretends to get like caught in by like some creature in the lake, but we're still like on edge for something haunting to be happening. We're like, is this going to be the thing that's finally exploding out? And something eventually kind of does emerge, but I don't want to give that away because it's done in such a really cagey, interesting way. For the most part, it's just really about one of my favorite subjects. You know, there's tons of movies about how great it is to be a kid and how free it is and you're getting your first love and all that kind of stuff. I love a movie that's about how terrifying it is to be a kid, especially those teenage years where you're starting to get a little bit of independence and you're kind of out in the world, but the world ends up being quite scary in a lot of ways. So naturally this 13-year-old boy has quite the crush on this 16-year-old girl and has no idea what to do with those feelings. And she's constantly kind of like half egging him on, half teasing him about it. And so he's just mostly terrified throughout the whole film. And that's kind of reflected in the kind of general supernatural vibe going on outside of it. And yeah, it was a film that I hadn't heard of at all until I saw a trailer for it when I was seeing something else at the Lumiere Cinema. And I was instantly pretty curious about it and was quite captivated by watching it. And it was a very impressive debut. Charlotte LeBron is apparently an actress whose work.
Yeah, I was just looking her up.
I recall, I don't think I've seen her in anything. The film's in French, but it's a Canadian production. So you also get a little bit of interesting kind of.
They speak French in Canada as well.
This is what I'm getting to, David. You also get some interesting culture clash where the main kid, his family almost exclusively speaks French. The girl's family speaks a mixture of French and English, and kind of the other kids they meet up with around this community mostly speak English. And so there's also this kind of like outsider status that he has within this community that's also really well kind of teased out. So yeah, very, very impressive debut and my number five.
Yeah, really, I think based on either your tweet or maybe you just telling me about it, I really wanted to see it and I actually had intended to see it, but it was, I had gone to Philly in New York and came back and I had planned to go see it the next night at the Lemley in Santa Monica, I think is where it was. And, ended up having so much work to catch up on from being out for a week that by the time I looked up, I was like, oh shit, the movie started 10 minutes ago. I guess I'm not going to make it.
Indeed.
But yeah, Charlotte LeBron as an actress, the only thing I have seen that she's in is Fresh, which is a movie that I did not like. And I don't remember her in. I think she might just be one of the other kidnapped women in that movie.
I did not see it.
Yeah, well, you're not.
It's about kidnapping, you say?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, she was apparently in The Walk, the Robert Zemeckis
movie. Which I never saw.
Good movie.
And I never saw The Walk or Man on Wire.
Role. Okay. Based on Wikipedia. So I guess I did see her in that, but I do not remember anything about her.
Just thinking about either of those movies, like I think I saw a trailer for Man on Wire before it came out and my palms got all sweaty. So I was like, I'm probably not going to see these movies anytime soon. All right. So number four for me.
Number five.
Number five for me. Sorry. Yeah, three of my five are movies that I saw at Sundance this year. So we're kicking off with Nicole Holofcener's You Hurt My Feelings.
Good film. Not on my list, but good film.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we were talking, I think, on a on the Patreon, I think, that has posted most recently. Hey, guys, if you're not a patron, sign up at patreon.com/battleshipretention. $2, $5, or $10 a month, depending on how much you want. And you get more stuff, and you help out us and you help out Tyler. So patreon.com/battleshipretention. Anyway, we were talking about the movie No Hard Feelings, which I have not seen and which you did not like. Also has feelings in the title. That wasn't that I just realized that wasn't even the point that I was making, but the idea
quick story on that. When I tweeted about my negative feelings on No Hard Feelings, somebody was like, oh, not usually a, oh shit. Now I can't think of the,
feelings.
She was like, not usually a Hall Center fan. And I was like, what's going on here?
I know a big part of the reason I think people are, as we talked about, some people are rallying around No Hard Feelings is that it's a certain kind of comedy that we see less of, especially in theatrical release. And I think You Hurt My Feelings is another kind that is like, it doesn't have any like broad comic conceits. It has a sitcom type of comic conceit.
For sure.
And it's a movie that is about real people in the real world that is that also pretty much doesn't let a single scene go by with at least one big laugh, often more. So that kind of like grown-up oriented comedy is also something that I miss and that I love about Nicole Holofcener and especially about Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I mean, I think what I've said about You Hurt My Feelings almost every time it comes up is that as far as Holofcener and Dreyfus go, I still prefer Enough Said.
Yeah.
But as a showcase for Julia Louis-Dreyfus's talents, I think this movie and her partnership with Nicole Holofcener just do it great. You know, she gets huge laughs out of the smallest line reads, including there's one moment that's a very emotional moment where she's crying because her husband like tries to defend himself and she like crying says like, oh, okay then.
Yeah.
It's like, it's one of the biggest laughs in the movie for me. You've also got the great Michaela Watkins. Tobias Menzies is hilarious. Jeannie Berlin has a couple of scenes and you can't ever go wrong by putting Jeannie Berlin in your movie. I wonder what she thinks of David Zaslav, that character, because she's a big she's a big TCM fan.
Yeah.
In the movie, although she thinks it's TMC.
Right.
And then when they correct her TCM, she says, why would it be called the channel movie? see, this has been, it's been 6 months and I still remember this movie so well. And a lot of little lines like that. And that's the sign of a good comedy and just a reminder that you don't have to have a big broad concept, you know, to have a good comedy. We used to have more comedies for adults, but then Woody Allen ruined it by being a creep.
What? There are larger forces at play than just Woody Allen.
Yeah. But I guess I feel like when I think of the type of comedy I'm thinking of, which is like New York professionals and their like petty like relationship problems, like I feel like Woody Allen was at one point kind of the standard bearer for this kind of comedy. His movies could be character-based and honest and emotional, but also incredibly funny. And I guess that's maybe Nicole Holofcener is with a movie like You Hurt My Feelings, which is a New York-based movie, is kind of filling that hole. I don't know. Who do you think of when you think of that kind of comedy?
Oh, I definitely think of Woody Allen, but you made it sound like with his downfall meant all of this type of movie is on a downfall, yeah. Which is an interesting proposition. Like, could, if you were still making movies, well, I mean, he is, but if you were still making movies and they were getting wider releases, would it have a greater effect on the larger box office? Would more people see these kind of movies, period? Or are we maximizing the audience we can get out of them because there's no Woody Allen movies around? I mean, I certainly wish Nicole Holofcener made movies as fast as Woody Allen did, at the very least. But perhaps she doesn't need to.
Do you know what I learned recently is that A Rainy Day in New York is apparently just quietly on Peacock.
I'm not surprised. I mean, I rented it on VOD, I don't know, years ago, whenever it, like, it came out. So it's been out there. So is Rifkin's Festival, which is probably...
Is it really?
Yeah. So I rented that last summer, I think it posted. It's probably the worst Woody Allen movie. I mean, it's really bad.
Really?
But
I mean, there's some contenders.
No,
Hollywood Ending is a real stinker.
So I haven't seen that. I mean, it's not like I've seen every Woody Allen movie, but of the ones I've seen, Rifkin's Festival is way up there. But frustratingly, it has an amazing ending that, like, kind of could be a capper on Woody Allen's whole career. So if you were to stop making movies and more people saw Rifkin's Festival, this would be like what they would lead with in, like, his obituary. But he's in production on yet another film, so it will kind of remain a weird outlier. The point is, you hurt my feelings. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to talk more about A Rainy Day in New York and Woody Allen in general.
Sure.
When Natalie and I were in Paris in 2019, A Rainy Day in New York was playing theatrically. And there was a part of me that just, like, perversely was like, I'm not going to get another chance to see this in the theater. Maybe I should go. And Natalie was like, I'm not even spending 90 minutes of my vacation watching a Woody Allen movie. So we didn't go. I also like, I can't remember how it, I know you bailed early on Difficult People. So I don't know if you got to.
I don't even know if I started on Difficult People.
Oh, you said you didn't. You didn't like it.
I know I watched a couple of episodes, but I can't remember if they were like the first couple or if I just kind of tuned in when, because Julie watched it consistently. I don't know if I just watched a couple of episodes with her kind of thing.
Well, there's a storyline where Julie gets cast in Woody Allen does within the show a second Amazon miniseries after Crisis in Six Scenes. It's pissed as his attempt to get TV right on the show. And I do appreciate that Difficult People's, like, line of attack isn't like what a creep Woody Allen is, but all about how tiny he is. And there's, there's a whole thing where they have to stop down production because no one can find Woody Allen. And it turns out he, like, curled up and went to sleep inside of a, like, shoe or something.
That's a good bit. I want to watch Difficult People. Yeah. Crisis in Six Scenes, by the way, that is a good show.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Rainy Day in New York, also not very good. It would have been a waste of time to go watch it. Yeah, you hurt my feelings. It didn't quite hit for me as big as it did for you. I liked it, but it kind of never quite rose above NPR chuckle for me kind of thing. Mm. I still really like all the performances, and I mean, most especially Julie Louis-Dreyfus and the husband's Tobias Menzies, right?
But Tobias Menzies, yeah.
Yeah, he's really great. The ones that got genuine laughs out of me was all the David Cross and Amber Tamblyn scenes, which were so funny.
Yeah, just Tobias Menzies plays a therapist, and they're a couple who are in therapy together, and yeah, very funny stuff. She accuses him of hating women. He says, no, I just hate you.
Yeah. And even when they get off screen and, like, they're sending him letters to get their money back from all their therapy.
And then one of his other patients is played by an actor comedian named Zach Cherry, and I like him a lot too. He's the one who, like, every time he, like, signs off or leave, you hear him muttering, like, fucking useless.
Yeah.
All right. We spent too long on You Hurt My Feelings for something that is only on one of our lists. So what's your number four?
Might be on your list too. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
Yeah, we'll get to that later.
All right.
So my number four, I'm going to guess it's not on your list because I think you were a little more mixed than I was on this. My number four is Wes Anderson's Asteroid City.
Yes, I am much more mixed on it, but you go first.
I definitely have my hesitations about this. Like, I think there are moments that remind me of what I don't like about early Wes Anderson, where some of the emotional beats feel like they're a little forced, or like he's pushing for them a little bit. And that's something that that never worked with me in Rushmore and even a lot of Royal Tenenbaums. It started to get better for me with Life Aquatic and then, you know, Fantastic Mr. Fox. And I still have not seen Darjeeling. I know that's one that people say I would like, but
I'd be curious. So I do have that one's like the most early Wes Anderson to me. It's like the last one he made in kind of his early phase, but it like really, he dives into that version of his aesthetic. So I'd be curious to hear what you thought.
So I do have some minor hesitations, but even those are kind of helped along by the fact that like, Jason Schwartzman is so at this point, like so keyed in to Wes Anderson that, I feel like he's selling moments. Like I don't know if people understand the conceit. It's very hard to explain.
I know. But
when he shows up to essentially surprise audition for Edward Norton and he like has that little speech, like I thought just the cat's pajamas. I love that scene. The scene with him and Margot Robbie, like I wanted to like, but that felt like that, like here's the emotional climax of the movie. And it felt a little forced anyway, but I'm talking about what I didn't like too much. What I did like is that, I like how much he has, as I said about French Dispatch, like it feels like the more Wes Anderson he gets, the more I like him. And he's so like disappeared into his own thing in a good way. That like, despite every apparently lame TikToker's attempt to make their own version of a Wes Anderson thing, no one else can do what he does. He's completely created his own world and his own language and outlook. And so this is a movie that is not only very Wes Anderson, I think there's something kind of about not just him, but like in the same way that I talked about The Fabelmans being about how difficult it is to be super talented, I feel like Asteroid City is about what I took away from it is this idea. It's this picture of people who come as close to understanding the beauty of the universe and are as keyed in to the beauty of the universe as you can be. And it just makes them all more sad. Just the more they're aware of beauty, the sadder they are. I also love that it's now that I'm after 17 years, almost 18 years, actually, pretty much 18 years of living in the Southwest, I have developed my own affinity for the desert, especially the strange part of it, out here where it feels like there are fewer barriers between the empirical and the mystical or whatever, and it feels like it's a place where you can sort of like come right up against the cosmos, and I love that it's a desert movie. It doesn't look like any other desert movie I've ever seen, and it's full of great performances and big laughs and moments that moved me. It might not, there's a good chance, but number four at halfway point, that it won't be on my top 10, but it's a movie that I'm very glad exists because no one else could have made it.
I'm with you on the humor of it, and I did appreciate kind of the cosmic angle of it. One of the reasons it doesn't look like any desert movie you've ever seen is because it was shot on a soundstage in Spain. They just built all that shit, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I think where I run up against it and why, and I think this is kind of a dividing line in what you and I might appreciate in Wes Anderson, since you like his later stuff more than I do, and I tend to like the earlier stuff, is his movies to me are at their best when they're kind of in conversation with, or even in conflict with, his desire for a sort of neatness and cleanness, contrasted with the real world elements around him. And there's an extent to which that's present here, because it's about people trying to maintain order in the face of something inexplicable and strange and wild. And also for the audience, very, very funny. It's just, it's kind of lacking any of that touchstone to the real world, and kind of touchstone to like base human impulses. Like, a huge thing I love in Wes Anderson's movies is his characters often reach a point where they can't express themselves and just have to resort to just cursing and other forms of vulgarity. And this is a pretty clean, unvulgar film, with the exception of a very quick blurred out nude shot. But even that's pretty tempered. And yeah, I mean, like I said, the humor did work for me. There's something else I was going to say on that kind of same tack. I think the film suffers a little bit in being a little overstuffed with characters. Sometimes you get some great side bits. Like, I love the little musical bit with Maya Hawke's class. But sometimes it felt like he was just writing scenes. I think Tilda Swinton's character is especially vulnerable here. Just writing scenes because he felt like he needed to justify getting the such great actors in for such small roles. And so some of that was kind of losing track of the central concerns of the piece for me. I'm definitely pretty mixed on it, but that's not to say I don't like it. I did like it. I just didn't love it.
As far as the overstuffedness of it, it's interesting that you've got Hong Chau and she doesn't even get a close up.
Yeah, right.
she's in one scene and it's all like wide, essentially. The singing scene, when Natalie and I saw it together and we were walking back to the car, and we both we were talking about who our favorite character was, and we both said Montana, the singing cowboy guy played by Rupert Friend, who is a very talented actor that I knew first from Homeland, but he's also in The Death of Stalin. He's Stalin's like fuck up son, like drunk fuck up son. And he's been in a number of things. I like Rupert Friend. Yeah, I can't remember. I was going to say something else about Hong Chau, but I can't remember. But she's great.
My favorite, I don't know if it's my favorite character, but I'm constantly grateful to Wes Anderson for casting Adrian Brody in major roles. I think he's really, really, really great in this, in a fairly small role, but a pretty pivotal one, I'd say, to the overall tenor of the piece.
Yeah.
And the other big laugh for me was when it's just after the town. I guess I'm being a little cagey about the central kind of concern of the film, because it's still, I don't know if tons of people have seen it, but it's just after the town's kind of like released what they've seen to the rest of the world, and Jeffrey Wright, who plays this like upper military brass guy, is like, we just received a communication from the president. There's kind of this big pause. He gets the envelope, he opens it, he just goes, he's furious, he just throws the message across the room. I laughed so hard at that.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. All right, what's your number three?
My number three is, I'd say, the latest film from, but at this rate he works at, certainly not the latest film from Hong Sang-soo, I think the most recent one to get distribution in the U.S. anyway, is Walk Up. As with most of his recent films, he is the writer, director, producer, cinematographer, editor, and composer on this film, which I haven't seen since AFI Fest last November, so I don't have the strongest memory for the details of it, but I do have a very strong memory of the feeling it kind of evoked. It's about, as with most Hong Sang-soo movies, a successful, semi-successful film director who's grappling with various elements of his life, this time via a walk-up apartment building. That kind of, in a series of stories, goes floor by floor through the building, And then maybe kind of wraps back around on itself in almost an M.C. Escher-like structure. The whole thing is really beguiling. It has the genuine feeling of a dream. And sometimes people say, like, it's dreamlike to just explain surreality. But that kind of stuff, like David Lynch films or like the dream sequences on Sopranos, never really felt like a dream to me, because they always kind of point out how unnatural they are. The thing about Walk Up is it feels completely natural until, like, suddenly you're like, wait a minute, that doesn't quite fit there because the person was back there. it starts to add up in a way that doesn't quite make sense, in the way that to me dreams really do, where like it makes sense for a good while of them, but maybe when you finally wake up or you get a certain way down the dream, you kind of have lost track of how you got there. So yeah, I really, really enjoy this. I really want to revisit it, in part so I can describe it better should it stay on my list for the end of the year. But this was the most I'd liked a Hong Sang-soo movie since probably Hotel by the River, which was 4 years ago, three or four years ago.
Christ.
Which, you know, for most filmmakers would be their last film. For him, it's like five or six films in between those 2 points.
Yeah.
Most of which I've really, really liked, but this one really caught my attention. And I know everyone has like, they're like, this is Hong Sang-soo's best in years film. So it gets tough to kind of track those recommendations. For most people, it's novelist film. And so don't just take my word for it, but this to me is a real standout endeavor. And it kind of like harkens back to some of his past work, which was more focused around like structure and repetition. This has the same kind of interest in that without being so dogmatic or diagrammic about it. This kind of embraces some of the more naturalist and almost surreal tendencies in building up sense, I'd say, on the beach at Home Alone at Night, or I guess really Yourself and Yours, while kind of harkening back to some of those earlier impulses. So yeah, he just continues to be such a fascinating filmmaker. And every time I think that like, I'm going to get sick of him, I guess, because he works so often, he ends up surprising me in some really refreshing way. So grateful for that.
Yeah. Every time you mention a movie that I had intended to see at AFI Fest and couldn't because of a major life event that got in the way, I just get so frustrated.
There's one more coming up.
This and yeah, then I won't say the other one, but yeah, like, and then yeah, so not gonna say anymore. All right, number three for me, and the second of three that I saw at Sundance, even though it actually came out in theaters like less than a week after it played Sundance, Brandon Cronenberg's Infinity Pool.
I just saw this yesterday,
but it's not on your list.
No.
Which I'm fine with. It's definitely nowhere near, it's not as good as Possessor. No. I'll say I loved Possessor, but I still appreciate, just like I talked about like Asteroid City being so Wes Anderson, this is clearly like so Brandon Cronenberg's kind of like obsessions, preoccupations, maybe, about sort of the mutability of flesh and identity and pain and pleasure and various bodily fluids all, you know, mixing together. And also, like with Possessors, a very, very dark comedy. And some just like flat out comedy. Mia Goth is very funny. There's a part at the beginning, so this won't be giving anything away, where Mia Goth reveals that she's an actress, but her specialty is being in those infomercials where it's like, there has to be a better way. Where
yeah,
people are like fumbling doing easy tasks, like putting things away or opening a bag or whatever. And so they ask her to demonstrate at dinner. And so she like fails at cutting a roll with a butter knife.
Yeah,
it's so good, it's so funny. All that stuff is funny, but then yeah, the movie gets very confrontational and upsetting and dark and bloody, but like it's I think I said this on another podcast, another episode maybe, that like the sexual content of it isn't very titillating, but some of the violence potentially is. And so that's, again, going back to that thing I'm saying about Brandon Cronenberg, is he's taking seemingly opposing things like pleasure and pain and mix them together, which is not like novel. Obviously, there's sadomasochism, and people have done this for a long time, but I find something really refreshing about how unselfconscious he seems about it, and how eager and giddy he is to push these things. You know, when I saw the press and industry screening I saw at Sundance, like walking out of the theater, there were a lot of people who like did not like the movie. And I was like, yeah, I bet he's okay with that. If people didn't like it for those reasons,
I think he'd have to be making that kind of movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really enjoyed it just as a ride.
Yeah, it's ways. Definitely that. And Mia Goth is fantastic. It sounds like we're dancing around the actual plot of the film, so I can't give away my favorite Mia Goth line. But there's a lot of stuff that on the page wouldn't really have much, I guess, kind of song to it that she really enlivens and makes really, really engaging. My biggest issue is that I just am not sold on Alexander Skarsgård as a leading man. This was my big problem with The Northman as well. This film, at least there's a point to him being kind of empty behind the eyes, but that's not enough to get me all the way. I don't know. I can feel him taking direction rather than kind of responding to the emotion of a scene. So I was kind of at sea through him, and a lot of the writing beyond that, I just found kind of underlining the point of the film a lot. So yeah, I was a little let down by Infinity Pool because I like Possessor so much. There's something kind of strange about the fact that Brandon Cronenberg is most famous for being David Cronenberg's son and making vaguely David Cronenberg-esque films, but all of his films are also about like essentially like absorbing someone's DNA and transmuting that into a new thing. That's like kind of strange, yeah, given the fact of his filmmaking, yeah, and lineage. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'll go back to what, I'll say what you said, that it, Alexander Skarsgård's, I like him more than you do, but I understand what you're saying about his, lack of star power, maybe. But I think the fact that he's playing a poser who's in over his head, it worked for me more than it worked for you, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Right to your limitations. Right. That's what I say. What around my number two?
Yeah, your number two. Yeah.
My number two is Rebecca Zlotowski's Other People's Children, which is, I think I've seen all of her films at this point. I've been a fan of hers. I really liked Grand Central. It was the first film I saw from her, which was a really ambitious, like nuclear love story about people like sort of falling in love, but mostly falling into a sexual relationship, like outside a nuclear plant. And the film was kind of like, have they absorbed some nuclear energy? And is that why they're boning so much? At least that's how I remember it. It was just a really strange film. And then, but I really loved Planetarium, which is the film she made with Natalie Portman. That's hugely ambitious and probably a little too much for most people, which is why it got terrible reviews. But I really latched onto it. She got some more fans with An Easy Girl, which was the very last film I saw before the COVID shutdown. And so it kind of had a dicey distribution pattern. It was a Netflix film that kind of barely got noticed, but those who saw it really kind of took to it. And then this film, she seems to have really sunk in finally with critics and the various tastemakers of the film industry. And like I said, rightly so. I do think it's the best film yet. It's at least semi-autobiographical. Virginie Efira plays a woman who's around 40 or so, maybe late 30s, who... just through various trials and tribulations, hasn't really settled down with a significant other and hasn't yet had a child. And that's kind of really getting to her. She recognizes the biological limitations she's about to hit and fears that she'll never really be able to start a family. When she meets a man, I think his name's Ali, who has a young daughter. And she really falls for him. And as she gets introduced to his family, really takes to his daughter as well, and she seems to really take to her in turn. The daughter's played by Callie, long last name here, Ferreira Goncalves, who gives maybe the most naturalistic child performance I've ever seen. Usually movie kids are like so annoying and so precocious, but this is just a very normal like 4 or 5 year old girl who's like always a little distracted, always a little spacey, very earnest in the way she gives love, but also easily put off by the most random circumstances. And Zlotowski's very smart about diving into all this, about like how meaningful this relationship can be. But Virginie Efira is also recognizing how tenuous her position in this family is, how like, in spite of the fact that she formed this very close bond, she has no, you know, legal right to this, to someone who's effectively becoming her daughter, and might not have a permanent bond with Ali as the relationship goes on. So even though they all mean a lot to each other, it could go away in an instant. And Virginie Efira, I also just saw Revoir Paris, which she also stars in, which is about a woman who's dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder after surviving a kind of like shooting spree kind of incident. And similar in both films, she has to communicate a lot just behind her eyes without being given the text to do so. And she carries that so well, kind of the anti-Alexander Skarsgård, where she's able to hold nothing in a scene that's dramatically there, but carry across so much drama within it. And there's a few scenes, especially towards the end, that are completely reliant on her just seeing something across the room, and Zlotowski's compositions, the story to that point, and Efira's performance telling us what's going on there, that really I found so, so moving. So yeah, I was very, very into this film. It kind of hit the similar tone as last year's One Fine Morning. Mia Hansen loved so much. It was in my top three, I think. And yeah, I could watch these kind of movies all day. So this is very much my vibe and very good form of it.
Yeah, this is my first Rebecca Zlotowski film. This is where that rule I said beforehand comes into play, because this is it premiered at festivals in 2022. But yeah, this movie is better than anything that is on my top five right now. It is my favorite movie that I saw at Sundance, but it had played the other festivals before, so I didn't count it. It's beautiful. I want to see some of her other films. I can see how, despite this being in many ways, a classical romantic melodrama, I can see how this is a woman who has made things that have been, like you said about Planetarium, too much for people. There's a boldness to her filmmaking. There's a thing where there'll be like iris transitions in this movie, but they're not like straight on. They like,
they kind of like wander over the frame.
Like kind of irregularly move. They're really interesting. I thought the movie was very beautiful. The guy who plays Ali, Rashdi Zem, had a good year, because he was also in Louis Garrel's The Innocents, which is also a very good movie.
Very good movie. Highly recommend.
Yeah. All right. So my number two, we're on to what was, I think, your number four. Kelly Freeman Craig's Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. For better or worse, I had not read the book going
Same.
In. I think it's knowing this is Kelly Freeman Craig's second feature after Edge of 17. Obviously, I understand that a lot of the credit for this story goes to Judy Blume. I don't want to take that away from her, but I think a lot of the credit for the telling also goes to Kelly Freeman Craig, because in both films, she has proven herself to be so uninterested in judging her characters. One of the things about Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, is that on the page, there are certain things that like feel like they're coming of age tropes. But I love, I'm forgetting her name, but I love that the mean girl in the movie,
mm-hmm.
Kelly Freeman Craig in the movie, they love her too. And they've been like, they're sympathetic towards her too. And yeah, I need to look up that actress, because it's low key one of my favorite performances of the year is that Mean Girls performance. L. Graham is the actress. The character's name is Nancy Wheeler. So there's just something so patient and beautiful and human about the telling of the story that also, as with You Hurt My Feelings, also has a lot of laughs in it without sacrificing the honesty of the psychology and of the emotions. I was going to steal a line from you, because I think you were going to say this too. Maybe I will. Best Rachel McAdams has ever been.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And yeah, on the humor part, it's so funny. And I think in terms of like, yeah, you can assign a lot of this to Judy Blume, but it's also hard to carry that dual tonality in a film. And I think like that was my big issue with No Hard Feelings, is like they're trying to make a comedy with a lot of drama in it and pulling off neither particularly well. This is one that like there can literally be a laugh 1 minute and then 30 seconds later something very, very moving, or vice versa. And some of it's in mm-hmm. the performances, some of it's in the editing. There's some funny just cuts to you know, people kind of leave a scene on one note, enter it on another, that always works. And the performances are all working really well in harmony, especially the fact that she's working with girls who are around the age she's depicting. You know, I'm guessing they're all in the 10 to 12 range. That's a tough age to exist in, let alone perform in a movie in, let alone be really good and naturalistic in a movie. And all the girls are Abby Ryder, Fortson in the lead role, most especially. But yeah, definitely Rachel McAdams' finest hour for me. And I've always liked her. I don't know why she's never really kind of sunk in. Maybe she just never had the right project to kind of get her to the higher profile I think she deserves to be in. But this kind of takes advantage of all of her gifts and gives her a new venue in which to put them. You know, she's entering the age of being a mom role, and she, you know, it's not like she hasn't played mothers before, but entering the age where she can be a mother to, you know, a young girl who can be the protagonist of a movie instead of just like an infant or a very small child or something. And yeah, it's one that it was tough to see that this didn't hit the box office, because it's such an audience pleasing movie and benefits so much from seeing with other people, because it just makes you feel better. I think it's such an old fashioned thing to say, but it's kind of an old fashioned movie in that way. It makes you feel better about humanity, about people in your community. And it's the kind of thing that movies used to be able to pull off much more reflexively, that is so rare, and which I'm so grateful to have Kelly Freeman Craig around. And I hope she gets to continue to work, even though neither of her movies has really hit. And I hope that, especially for
Not in the moment.
Yeah, it's true. But
I feel like Edge of 17 like has legs, and like with and people remember that movie, and especially people younger than us, younger than we, I should say, grammatically, remember that movie. So I don't know what that counts for in David Zaslav's Hollywood, but I do think that Edge of 17 has stuck around in the consciousness.
But that's the question, right? It's like, can films have legs anymore? There's no home video, so you're not, you know, getting a bump of DVD sales. It's like, does it count if more people stream it on Netflix anymore? Somebody was tweeting about this recently with like the Disney movies getting shut off Disney Plus. Like, there's really no avenue for something to become a cult hit anymore, to have that second wind of revenue that made Fight Club an eventual hit, or made Office Space an eventual hit. Like, all that stuff that home video really bolstered just gets harder and harder to push through in the market.
But yeah, but I wanted to say one more thing about Rachel McAdams, just to be, look, you're going to be the one who is, raining on the No Hard Feelings parade. So, not to be out contrarianed, I'm going to point out that Game Night never meant as much, like never hit as much with me as I think it was supposed to, as it did with so many other people. It's not bad. It's quite good. And I do think Rachel McAdams has a couple of the best scenes in it. She has the scene where she's really removing the bullet from Jason Bateman's leg is maybe the best scene in the movie. And then also her reaction, spoilers for Game Night, when the dude gets sucked into the plane turbine and she goes, yes, oh, he died.
Iconic for a reason.
I think about that all the time.
I'm actually with you on Game Night. I liked it, but I didn't love it.
Yeah, but I want to see. I hear good things about the Dungeons and Dragons movie that the same guys.
It's good.
Made.
I mean, it's kind of like same thing as Game Night. Like I enjoyed it a lot. It's not obviously one of my five favorite movies of the year so far, and it's not even on my runners up. But
well, I don't know. We haven't gotten to your number one, so it could have been the Dungeons and Dragons movie.
Twist.
All right, what is your number one?
My number one is, of course, for listeners who have been consistent with the podcast, Laura Citarella's Trinque Lauquen. I can never say that damn movie title correctly. I think it's Trinque Lauquen. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not Argentinian.
I wouldn't know. I didn't get to see it.
Yeah, well, you missed out on people semi-frequently saying the title of the film, which vaguely helped. So this is, it's a very interesting film. It's a semi-sequel to a film she made in 2011, called Ostende, which we talked about when we did our Argentinian films episode, and which I think you can seek out through legal means. I can't remember if that was one that I downloaded or not, but it's not necessary to see that film before seeing this one. It's mainly that Laura Paredes, who's the main character here, we'll get to that in a second, that's more or less plays the same character that she does in Ostende.
You can rent Ostende on Prime. Ostende.
It's as well, you should.
On Amazon.
It's a very good film. It's only like 80 minutes, as contrasted with Trinque Lauquen's 4.5 hour runtime. Lest anyone be intimidated by that, it's a 2-part film. So you can very easily watch one part one time, next part the next night or the following weekend, like whatever you like. Not too necessary to watch it all in one sitting, though I think it would be beneficial if you could. So Laura Paredes plays a woman who at the start of the film has gone missing, and these two guys, Ezequiel and Raphael, are looking for her, and we gradually find out that the two of them are linked to different parts of her life. Ezequiel is a coworker of hers, Raphael is her boyfriend, but also within those two separate roles, they've also had things to do with her personal life and with her professional life, even though they're on paper fulfilling the roles in distinct worlds, those two worlds have mixed together for Laura. And it takes some time before we get to any real scenes with Laura herself, and it takes some time for her to gradually become kind of emerge as the main character instead of just the main subject. What we find out is that she had checked a library book out of the library and found within it a love note, essentially, that was meant for somebody else who had the book at the time, one supposes. And she just kind of becomes fascinated with this note and keeps diving further and further into the person who wrote it, who they're writing it to, what their lives look like, and everything else. So it's about two guys who are investigating the disappearance of a woman who in turn was investigating some of the people who are strangers to her. And the whole film, first of all, is incredibly engaging. Despite its 4.5 hour runtime, it for me anyway, flew by. And I saw it at AFI Fest last November. And my memory at the time is that I was stressed about work or something. I remember in general over that weekend feeling like I wouldn't have the mental energy to devote to the motion pictures the way I would like, and having zero trouble getting wrapped up in this one. It kind of very quickly hit for me and very quickly got me involved, and is very funny in the way that I think people who are at least loosely familiar with contemporary Argentinian cinema will recognize. Certainly if you saw The Floor, the sense of humor is very similar. Where this cut above La Flor for me, and why I think it might be the best Argentinian film I've seen, is that it's not only about, you know, the pleasure of storytelling and the effect that stories have on our lives or whatever. It's really about the strange human impulse to get wrapped up in other people's lives and to ascribe meaning to those lives that we cannot picture, and how difficult it is to really know anyone else. So for the two guys looking for Laura, they think they're very close to her, but are discovering this whole world that they weren't really privy to, and which doesn't really concern them. And so it's also conversely, or really relatedly, about kind of the masculine, I think especially masculine, but especially when you're in any kind of romantic entanglement with somebody else, to assume that everything they do is somehow about you. The reasons Laura has gone missing and departed has nothing to do with these two guys, and the extent to which she wants them to look for her is very much up in the air right up through the end. And I think kind of remains a bit of a mystery and a bit of an ambiguous note throughout the film. And then conversely, like, Laura's looking for these people who she doesn't know at all and is wrapped up in their lives and is trying to give meaning to her own life through theirs. And that is in and of itself not necessarily an empty pursuit, but certainly a big gamble to assume that whatever she finds out will fill a big gap that she senses in her life. There are innumerable small details that are worth obsessing over within this film. It's incredibly well put together. Citarella and Paredes actually wrote the film together, and it reflects a great deal of thought put into it. And I'm not sure how long they've been working on it. Ostende was 12 years ago, I think they made that. And Laura Citarella has contributed in various capacities to other Argentinian films since then. This is her first directed film since then, and reflects, I mean, again, I don't know if they worked on this whole time, but it reflects 12 years of thought. It's a pretty significant piece of work, and pretty significantly thought through and expressed. And despite its runtime, I've been looking for an excuse to try to see it again. It had been showing at the Lumiere Cinema for several months, but only on like Sunday afternoons because of its runtime. So it's been tough to see again. But as soon as it's available digitally, I will absolutely be doing so, because I was just so enraptured by it.
All right, we're on to my number one, and I'm going to surprise no one. I'm going to be very basic here and pick Celine Song's Past Lives as my best film of 2023 so far. Celine Song is a playwright, as is Greta Lee's character in the movie, as I if I remember correctly. It's been since January since I saw it, but that's what I remember. And this is her directorial... This is her directorial debut. I feel like when someone comes from the theater, or when a play is adapted into film, or someone comes from the theater, there's a worry that it's going to go one of two ways. Either it's going to be very like boring cinematically, or they're going to try and overcompensate by making it too overstuffed and too let's do things we can't do and add a bunch of locations and stuff, things we couldn't do in the theater. There's an incredible like patience and maturity and sophistication, I think, to the execution of Past Lives and its sort of visual and editorial sort of rhythm and cadence. It's very patient. I will give some of the credit to cinematographer Xavier Kirshner, who was Steve McQueen's collaborator on all five Small Axe films, shot this. And then also, since I'm, you know, going back, I mentioned Woody Allen. Since we're talking about canceled directors today, I'll talk about something that Joss Whedon once said about like casting people who are good at comedy, because that's the hard one. And Greta Lee is someone who very much comes from the world of comedy. I know her from High Maintenance and Girls and Inside Amy Schumer, and she is an actor that I associate with comedy. And here, like, not that there aren't, you know, the movie's very human, and so there are moments of very human sort of comedy in it, but this is not a movie. You wouldn't describe the movie as a comedy. It's a movie about a Korean-born woman whose family immigrated to Canada, and then by the time we catch up with her, she's an adult artist living and working in New York with her white husband, and then her boyhood or childhood friend from Korea comes to visit New York City, and they spend time together. And, you know, I guess in a superficial sense, maybe there's sort of a like romantic spark, but it's also a movie that's ruminating on all the, yeah, I mean, it's called Past Lives for a reason. Every, like, all the different possibilities that we leave behind by making one decision or another. And it seems to present this idea almost of time travel, but in a sense, in a way where you can only look at the past and you can't interact with it. And so there's a yearning and a bittersweetness to it. There's a scene, very quiet scene late in the movie at a bar, where the Tae-yu is the actor, Hae-sung is the character, Hae-sung and Greta Lee and her husband, played by John Magaro, an actor I also like, are just at a bar together after having had dinner. And it is maybe my favorite scene in any movie in 2023 so far. You saw it, right?
I did. I think I had an interesting experience with it because it was so beloved out of Sundance. I was having trouble latching into its rhythms because it cuts through a lot of time very quickly and then kind of settles on a specific moment to go from. So I was having trouble settling into its rhythms. And then, like, quite suddenly, the ending really hit like a ton of bricks. And so I kind of want to go back and watch it again because I'm like, clearly something was working for me much more so than I was necessarily giving the film credit for in the course of its running. So I do think it's really masterfully directed, and especially for, it's her debut film, right? Especially for a debut, it definitely carries a sense of longing even when in its choppier parts, and that all worked pretty well. There's some elements of the performances that I had maybe some struggles with, you know. I think there's some moments where it fits John Magaro into a position where I understand why people in the theater I was in were laughing at him, because he's kind of like put in an almost kind of pathetic position of like being the third wheel in his own marriage kind of thing. Which I think the film is mostly pretty smart about, but sometimes it felt like it didn't quite know what to do with them. So again, it's one that I hope to have a chance to revisit because I don't really think these doubts or issues I had with it held it back from really moving me. It's just that I thought about them in the moment, and so I've kind of held on to them.
Yeah. This is one of those, I think, very positive Sundance stories where, like, going into Sundance, I don't think, my recollection is this was not talked about as one
right
to watch. In fact, so just to talk chop or whatever, the post COVID, the Sundance like press passes have worked differently. So like the level that I'm at now, I don't get any public tickets. I only get to see press and industry screenings, whereas I used to get an allotment of public tickets, but you can always just ask publicists for public tickets,
right?
You know? And so I ended up going to a few of those, and Past Lives was a pretty easy one to get tickets for at the Everett's premiere at the Eccles. That was not a difficult one to get tickets for. And then as the like credits started to roll and I tuned into the chorus of sniffles around me, I realized even before the lights had come up, I was like, this is, people are loving this. Yeah. This is going to be a big story. And it was. So yeah, we did it. We talked about our top five.
Right on. Do we want to do some quick honor roll mentions?
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do four honorable mentions, but real quick. But I'm going to do two that are legitimately 2023 movies, and two that are movies that came out in America in 2023. So I'm going to talk about a little seen and little discussed, I guess, Chinese film called Stonewalling, which is directed by someone named, oh, it's two people. I think it's a married couple, Ji Huang and Ryuji Otsaku. And it is a 2.5-hour movie that I guess the baseline of the story is that it's about a young woman who gets pregnant, you know, out of wedlock or whatever, and does not want to have an abortion. And so it's about her going through the process of adoption I'm not sure what the right term is, but it also uses that length, the period of a pregnancy, to just be an overview of this family over time and the way that normal people interact with. I mean, I think it's one of those movies that's probably, I think it's critical of China, but of Chinese society, but in a way that's like not overt enough to be like overly censored. But there's a lot of like black market type of stuff going on, and people taking advantage of one another, and also COVID happens like in the middle of the movie. And so we see like her family own a store selling, I can't remember what, but they pivot to just like buying a bunch of like masks and hand sanitizer and stuff.
Right.
And that's what they sell now. Which is like, so they're kind of complicit in like the black market and profiting off of other people as well. Anyway, I went on too long, but Stone Rolling is very good. My other one that's 2022, played TIFF last year, but I didn't get to see it. Daniel Goldhaber's How to Blow Up a Pipeline, which I think I'm going to say will, if we're still doing Battleship Retention and if the world still exists at the end of 2029, How to Blow Up a Pipeline might very well make my list of the 10 best films of the decade.
Really?
Yes, I was completely riveted by it and invigorated by its energy but complete lack of conservative moralizing about what these people are doing.
The latter part is definitely the part I like the most about it.
Yeah. And also your friend and mine, friend of this podcast, Sean Ingram, he texted me after he saw the movie. So I can't know exactly what he said, but he said, so Sasha Lane is on a one masterpiece a decade trajectory, which is not bad. So yeah, those are my two 2022 ones. And then my two 2020, like legit premiered and released 2023, honorable mentions. Polite Society was the most pleasant surprise.
I still need to see it
for me.
I really want to.
Yeah. I think, I saw like, oh, it's a family drama being expressed via martial arts tropes. I was like, this is going to be another like cutesy full of itself, everything everywhere all at once type thing. But it's much more like the Edgar Wright Cornetto trilogy type of things, where it's always real. It's often very funny. The characters are flawed. And not flawed in the like point making way of everything everywhere all at once. Like they're actually just like messy people. It's got great performances, great action. And then my final honorable mention, and you can find it on Shudder if you have Shudder, Ted Gagan's Brooklyn 45, which is a low budget sort of locked room horror movie period piece in which a bunch of World War II vets, high-ranking World War II vets, come together a year after the war at Christmas time to see one another again. But shortly after they arrive, their host, the retired general played by Larry Fessenden, which is how you know if you're watching an indie horror movie and Larry Fessenden's in it, you made the right choice. His imprimatur is not taken lightly. He reveals that actually the reason I've gathered you all here is I want to do a seance to contact my late wife, and they do, and things go horribly awry. And I think it ends up being a movie kind of, I was definitely put in mind of The Hateful Eight in terms of it being about like a bunch of Americans, or some characters maybe not American or not American born immigrants in there, locked in a room together and forced to spell out what they think America is. But it's not in like, it's not a, what's what I'm looking for? It's not strident. It's not a polemic. Didactic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a kick-ass little slow burn, and a slow burn horror movie that occasionally has explosions of gore that I'm not gonna expand upon. But yeah, Brooklyn 45, another like really pleasant surprise for me. All right, honorable mentions for you.
Yeah, all these pretty narrowly missed my list. I think the only one that had a longer shot was Blue Jean, which is really good. Story of a woman who's a closeted gay woman in the late 80s in the UK, where they just enacted some extremely strict, essentially don't say gay kind of laws. Very, very good look at the time. Not at all. I mean, nostalgic is a real weird word to potentially use for a woman, a movie about harsh gay oppression. But yeah. Even the most, like, you've seen this before, where even the most kind of downbeat movie can be nostalgic for a period. It's just very naturalistic. You could almost mistake it for a film shot in that period. As a great, great big performance. RMN, Christian Mongeau's latest film, is really, really good and just as masterfully done as anything he's made before, with an extra air of mystery and potentially surreality that I found very intriguing, and which I'm still kind of wrapping my head around, but which has really stuck with me. Kelly Reichardt's Showing Up, her latest collaboration with Michelle Williams, is another one that I really want to see again, not because I didn't like it, although I did watch it like I think 3 days after getting laid off, so I was not really in the best like headspace, but sure, it still hit pretty hard. But it's also like, I mean, even for Kelly Reichardt, a very slight movie in the way of like nothing really changes throughout the movie, but there are these small shifts, which are the kind of movies that I tend to really like and really did like it here, but which is just kind of full of small details that it's hard to say, like, what are the small details that are really affecting the course of the story? So I'd like to watch it again, kind of with its trajectory more in mind. It honestly kind of felt like an expansion tonally of the Michelle Williams section of Certain Women, which has become now like my favorite section of that movie, even though at first glance it appears to be the slightest. It has so much going on in the kind of the little crevices and in between parts, and that's like a lot of what Showing Up is all these kind of like tiny things adding up. And it's also weirdly like the funniest Kelly Reichardt movie so far, which is not like, we don't really think of her as a big comedy director, and it's not like it's an out and out laugh fest, but it is really sharp and has a great sense of the city of Portland, which I definitely appreciate. One that came probably the closest to making my list, 1001, which is a really great parental melodrama that itself takes some pretty big swings, I would say, narratively, and lands way more of them than I would expect given the basic description of it, which could definitely make it seem overstuffed and way too much, but it really captured them all, and especially through the lead performance of, I think, Teyana Taylor's her name. I know she's a famous singer who I should be more familiar with, but I'm not that hip. But she's so good in the movie, and hope that this portends to more acting credits in her future. And then lastly, I got to admit,
we talked about this before.
I know she's been in movies, but I'm saying like more.
She's been in movies and TV. She has 59 credits on IMDb.
Was it that many? I thought it was much fewer than that. All right.
Yeah. I think this is just like us showing our like bubble that like she seems like a new discovery to us because she's hasn't been in things that like white art house goers go to see.
But isn't it just still like her first
coming
like,
to role? America? And oh, maybe it might be.
So I guess that's what I have in mind is like,
yeah,
more big meaty stuff.
Yeah. Also, I'm looking a lot of the, okay, it says 59 credits. A lot of these are her music videos. That doesn't really count.
Yeah. I was going to say, I thought her credits were like 10. So you were saying 59. Yeah. I was like, okay, maybe I'm just completely lost it. But
well, it's somewhere in between 10 and 59.
All right, sounds good. And then lastly, I got to admit, I loved Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. It is gorgeously rendered and hits kind of my bare minimum threshold of like the superhero movies, like, is it romantic and does it have a great female character in it? It has both of those things and does them so well and is so visually enveloping that I saw it twice in theaters and just soaked in both times.
Yeah, another one I tried to see, but just alas, been too busy. Been too busy. All right. Well, this has been fun. We'll do a much longer version of this at the, well, not at the end of the year, next March, I think. Yeah. We'll do our actual top 10 of 2023. But it's fun to highlight the good movies that come out in the first half of the year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Often get forgotten. You know, by the time of award season. What do you think is most likely to be an awards contender that has already come out? Is it Past Lives?
I would say so. Okay. That seems like one that really kind of landed and stuck around. Trying to think of what else that maybe isn't on my list, but which is kind of landed with more of a hit. I mean, I was surprised
that 1001.
Yeah, definitely. I was surprised that 1001 didn't land bigger because it feels like the kind of movie that should have. But Blackberry, I think, will hit with a lot of critics' prizes, especially for the script. Master Gardener has a lot of strong admirers, so I think critics groups will still latch onto it. Oh, Asteroid City, I think. It seems like it's really, and it's a big box office hit for that scale of movie. So, I wouldn't be surprised if that stuck around.
And yet you'll be able to rent it on VOD in less than a week.
I don't get it. Makes no sense to me.
Strange choice. Very strange choice. All right. Well, this has been great. You can find reviews of some of these movies, I guess, at battleshipretention.com. You can, check out the GoFundMe, like I said. Follow me on Twitter at Davey Pretension. Check out my other podcast, The One Where I Met Your Mother, where my wife Natalie and I watch an episode of Friends and an episode of How I Met Your Mother. Met Your Mother every week. We just passed episode 100 of How I Met Your Mother, which means we've done more than 100 episodes of the podcast at this point.
Nice.
So that's where you can find me. Oh yeah, David at battleshipretention.com is my email. Scott, where do you want people to track you down?
Twitter, Rail of Tomorrow, Letterboxd, my name, Scott Nye, and on Blue Sky, I guess, like, it's not really at Rail of Tomorrow, I guess it is. I'm sure if you search for Scott Nye or Rail of Tomorrow, it'll come up. And not on Threads. If somehow Twitter and Blue Sky fall and it's only left with Threads, I will simply have no app like Twitter. I have zero interest in joining up Threads. It will never happen.
I joined Threads just to post one post.
Okay. Make your mark.
Yeah. And people can look at it if they want. That's it. Great. Thanks for listening.
And we'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.